Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Did you know that San Francisco's budget is bigger than the state of Arizona's? Well, tonight we ask, why is San Francisco's $12.2 billion budget so big and projected to grow even bigger next year? There were a flurry of articles earlier this year in the wake of multiple Silicon Valley IPOs in the Washington Post and the New Yorker that started to call attention to our city's challenges, from homelessness to housing to drug addiction and mental health crises. And of course, there's the concerns that President Trump raises about San Francisco. But shouldn't our progressive city be leading the way in solving these issues? Where is all the money going? Well, depending on who you talk to, the answers may not be that simple. And others, they are that simple. So we've brought together a group of voices tonight to help tease this apart and figure out where it does all that money go and what does it pay for and what do we get in return for that investment. So tonight we have three guests, one on the phone. We'll start with him, former San Francisco Supervisor John Avalos. He represented District 11 on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors from 2009 to 2017, and he served as the chair of the Budget and Finance Committee from 2009 to 2010. Welcome, John Avalos.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
And in the studio with me this evening, we have two guests who are Bay Area natives. They went to Piedmont High School together, it turns out, but have taken different paths since, which may inform the perspectives they'll bring to our conversation this evening. And we're happy to bring them together in the studio tonight. They are Philip Sprinson, veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps, project manager at WebCorp Builders, and author of the recent article on San Francisco's budget in the Manhattan Institute's City Journal entitled, Where Has All the Money Gone? Well, welcome, Philip.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
And we're joined by Joe Eskenazi, managing editor of Mission Local and former senior editor at San Francisco Magazine. He's also written for SF Weekly, The Chronicle, and The Examiner, as well as other publications. Welcome back to City Visions, Joe.
Oh, glad to be here.
And in about 20 minutes, we'll open our phone lines to you, our listeners, to join our conversation. I'll give you that phone number now. It's 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send in your questions or comments at any time to our panel by emailing us at cityvisions@kalw.org. So, Philip Sprinson, actually, I wanted to start with you. Where Has the Money Gone is the title of your piece that was published in City Journal back in August. And I thought is a good way to kind of set the stage for your perspective on this issue. Wanted you to read a little bit of that article to us.
Certainly. In 2009, San Francisco's municipal budget totaled $6.5 billion, $8.6 billion in today's money, adjusted for inflation and population. San Francisco's actual budget for 2019 is an eye-popping $12.2 billion, a 10% increase just since 2018. The city has failed to match this staggering budget growth with a similar increase in capital investment or services, however, providing an object lesson in the limits of what money can do. Companies like Google, Salesforce, and Uber, headquartered in and around the city, pour sky-high salaries and stock option windfalls into the local economy, which has seen real estate values and the cost of everything else soar. City coffers overflow with tax revenue. Though the effect has been most pronounced for the past decade, it extends as far back as the first dot-com boom 20 years ago. In 1999, the city budget was $4.2 billion, equivalent to just $7.7 billion today. The excess budget above inflation and population growth over those 20 years totals an astonishing $23 billion. What has San Francisco done with this wealth? Not much. The Municipal Transportation Agency, MUNI, which runs the buses and metro, has struggled with failure after failure this year. The housing shortage in the city is so bad, it is driving people to live in cars and even boats. Homelessness is up 14% in the past 6 years. Dirty streets, with needles and worse on the sidewalks, were an issue in last year's mayoral race. A city, seemingly rich enough to pave its roads with gold, finds them instead covered with trash.
So, Philip, that's a pretty bleak picture that you paint there, and I'm going to have our other guests comment on your take on the state of the city and its budget. First, I wanted to ask you, what has prompted you to write this article in the first place?
I wrote an article on a different subject on spec a couple of months ago when I read a piece in the Chronicle, and it related to some items at this particular website, City Journal, that I've read there before. So I wrote the article on spec, and I sent it to them saying, I saw this in my local neighborhood, and this relates to things you talk about where they're from in New York. And they published the piece, and then they asked me to have any other subjects to talk about because they were interested in expanding their coverage in the Bay Area because of how prominent we are currently in the national politics and discussion about urban issues. And I suggested this because this was around the same time that the fiscal year budget came out over the summer, and they asked to hear about it. So I did some research and put this together.
And is this something that you come to do as part of wanting to draw attention to a problem because this is an area of interest of yours? What was it that really got under your skin to make this, to write this article?
I think, yes, drawing attention to what I think is an issue and not even necessarily a partisan or policy issue. It's not about what you're spending on. It's the issue of if you have so much money and the revenue is increasing so much, what are you doing with it? And do you have some very clear goals and vision of what you're going to do with this phenomenal wealth? Or are we sort of just proceeding on the same path without a very clear roadmap of where we're going and what we're going to do with the money?
So, in fact, the subtitle of your article, San Francisco's Political Leadership Has Squandered a Fortune. So I wanted to bring in our other guests here to set the stage here of how each of us sees or each of you sees the city's budget and where the money has gone, so to speak, by asking you, Joe Eskenazi, what do you take when you hear what Philip has to say? Does this ring true for you in some ways and in others not?
Yes, and I think that articles like this are valuable, and I think it's good to have outside voices questioning what San Francisco does, because while I think a lot of the outside analysis of the city is off the mark, I think that that there's a defensiveness internally as well. I wrote 10 years ago when you began the story there in 2009 with my writing partner Benjamin Wax, an article called The Worst Run Big City in the United States, and we broke down the per capita budget for San Francisco, and it's far, far higher per capita than anywhere else, no matter what you do. When we get to the issue, though, and I think Philip and I are in agreement here, I'm always concerned when you're dealing with astronomical numbers like this, but I think more people need to say, are we getting $12.3 billion worth of good out of the budget? And I don't think we are. Breaking down what to do and how to look at the numbers is difficult, though, because you can't just move the money around willy-nilly. For example, more than half of our budget is not general fund, and you can't take money from, say, increased runway fees at the airport and use them to build affordable housing. That money, and that's a big driver of where the budget has gone, goes only and can only be spent on the airport. The same with the Public Utilities Commission, which is providing water and power for a good portion of the Bay Area. You can only spend that money there. So you have to also then look at the general fund. And the general fund has gotten huge, of course, but we have voted more earmarks into the general fund than any city perhaps in the known universe. So $1.5 billion is taken off the top right there. So I'm not going to say that San Francisco is doing budgeting well, but it becomes more complicated the more you look at it.
And John Avalos, you were in the midst of this a number of years back as chair of the Budget Committee on the Board of Supervisors and then on the Board of Supervisors for almost, well, for 8 years. So tell us what your perspective as someone from the Board of Supervisors, a politician, a legislator, how do you look at this question?
Well, on the Board of Supervisors, I was actually one of the outliers when it came to looking at the budget. I happened to be the budget chair from in 2009 and in 2010 when we were facing $500 million budget deficits. And it was when we had these budget deficits that we had to make hard choices on the budget. I agree with what Joe Eskenazi said, that we just can't conflate the entire budget with discretionary funding that we can put to any purpose, especially looking in hindsight. That's not how our budget works, the way that Mr. Sprinton has described it in his article. There are only certain amounts of money that can be used discretionary. I actually had worked very hard to make priorities in the budget, and that means cutting from some places and adding the budget in other places. I got to actually retool Gavin Newsom's budget 2 years in a row and made significant changes in the budget when that happened. Since that time, when we actually have restored a lot of money for substance abuse services and mental health services, for senior programs, we prevented the privatization of jail health services in San Francisco. If you look at jail health services in Alameda County, you see that there's been a lot of deaths because the profit drive has actually led to people not getting the health care they need in that system. So we did a lot of things that actually were about making sure the city was making real choices about how we spent our money. But since that time, we've had an ever-growing budget when we got past the Great Recession, and the city hasn't been making real choices about how to prioritize funding. It's actually, you have 11 supervisors and you have a mayor. The mayor has all the control of the budget. You have all these folks who are in elective office who have made a series of promises to residents and department heads and to unions and the city workers, and everything gets locked in until there's more of a political process rather than a policy-making process when it comes to balancing the budget.
So if you could stay with us for another second here and actually just kind of break it down. Joe started to do that. How much of the budget is earmarked or set aside, and where is it set aside to, and what are some of the fixed costs that are just there no matter what, that really do limit the amount of discretionary funds?
Sure. The general fund discretionary money that's actually available to spend on any purpose whatsoever is actually money that has to go towards the police and has to go to every general fund department, the Rec and Park department, and departments that don't have a full baseline that funds their budget. That amount of the budget is about $2.2 billion out of the $2 billion that you mentioned earlier. That's a very small part. It's one-sixth of the budget is actually discretionary. But it's actually not totally discretionary because the Board of Supervisors and the mayor are never going to talk about, they're never going to, remove the police department from the budget. So therefore, you have to have spending, for public safety, and that's going to be the police department. Every other department in the general fund works that way as well. We have baselines. The overall general fund part of the budget is $3.3 billion. In our baselines that we have, that we have to actually spend money, it's earmarked for particular purposes. This includes the library, the children's fund, the education fund. There are senior services. There's a certain amount of money that has to go for staffing levels in the police department. And so that takes up about 1.5 the set-asides that we have in the budget. Then you have, other departments that have to spend money that you get from the federal government that goes into our general fund that has to go for particular federal programs like Medi-Cal and CalFresh and in-home supportive services. So when it really comes down to it, because we're a city and a county, we get a lot of county funds that other municipalities don't get that actually inflates our budget to be much larger. And we have particular mandates about how we spend our money on these services that are earmarked in various places. And plus, we have our set-asides. Then you have the rest of the budget. So we talked about overall, is it $5.5 billion is general fund dollars. The rest of it is non-general fund dollars. That's non-discretionary money, money that some departments generate their own revenues themselves, like the airport that Joe Eskenazi mentioned, but also the Public Utilities Commission. And when it comes to the Public Utilities Commission, in Princeton's article, it almost states that there's been no major infrastructure that's been developed in the city and county in the past 20 years. Well, actually, the past 20 years, we've actually redeveloped our entire water system from Hetch Hetchy in Yosemite Valley to your water faucet. Every part of it has been redone, and that's a multi-billion dollar project that's been where some of the money has gone over the years. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard to conflate, all of this, spending. And I'll add one other thing. We live in a city that actually has put to the national level a Speaker of the House, a senator who's running for president, another senator who's been there for many years, and a governor of California. We have a city that has incredible amount of wealth and incredible amount of power to determine who is running this federal government and who is running our state government and who is running our local government. And so when it comes to how our city has been a wealthy city, we've seen that that wealth has gravitated to the most rich and powerful people, has undercut the middle class and put a lot of people who are in San Francisco on the streets where they are scrabbling for a living. And that's the problem that we have to deal with. We have a system, an economic system that advantages people at the top, and we don't have the government resources to deal with the consequences of that.
So I want to let Philip respond. So Philip, it sounds like our other two guests feel like there's lots of questions that you raise that are important, and there's a lot of details in the way that the budget of San Francisco is constrained by set-asides and mandates that don't really paint the full picture of how much money really is at play here. So I wanted to hear a little bit more about what you think about that response.
I think in many respects they are absolutely correct. You know, that there are certain structural issues built into the San Francisco budget, particularly in voter-mandated set-asides that the Board of Supervisors can't change, and in the independent agencies that the airport and PUC and others that collect revenue that only goes to them. But that said, the growth in the budget has been so phenomenal in recent years that it's difficult to say that, you know, the entire 12.2 is be locked up and spoken for, and there's no flexibility in what San Francisco could do. Supervisor Avalos said, you know, really only 2.2 is truly flexible. That would suggest that $10 billion is completely locked up. And yet as recently as 2016, the entire city budget was only $8.5 billion, including discretionary and everything else. So when you add $3.7 billion in, you know, the course of just 4 years, you know, clearly there's some extra money to be able to play with in some form or another. The other thing I would note is that all of the structural issues, which do exist, are themselves a choice of the city and its voters. And part, I would hope, would have, you know, the mandate of the Board of Supervisors under the situation would be to reassess. And if at a certain time when budgets were tight, the city, say, put in set-asides, it said that Muni must get this much because there's a certain level of service we don't want to cut. Well, Muni's budget has grown 25% in the past 10 years. Perhaps maybe now we need to go back to the voters and reassess our set-asides or reassess how we allocate and the straitjackets we put ourselves in so that we can use some of this money for beneficial purposes.
So, Joe, to follow up on what Philip just said, is there more money at play here, so to speak, than perhaps there is? Or is it really, truly locked into place as much as it is? Because then the questions are different depending on what the root cause is here of the problem.
What Philip's right about is that we did this. We voted a lot of those set-asides. And whenever times are tough, it's the departments that don't have a set-aside that are going to be bothered first. We voted set-asides for the library. You can't go after them. We voted set-asides for various other departments. But so it's the departments that don't have a set-aside that suddenly face budget consequences. Right
but
now,
is that because those departments were the first to get cut in other downtimes?
No, and it's because people like libraries. It's because people like children.
To that?
It's because people like animals.
Yeah, libraries are a place that serve a lot of people who are mm-hmm. homeless. So,
yeah.
I mean, you go into the main library, you go to libraries all over the city, and it's actually one of those services that actually is doing something to give people who are homeless a place of respite off the street.
I mean, I often think about this. The libraries, I think, are one of the most well-functioning elements of all San Francisco. But to get to the point, you know, we are getting our money's worth there, right? But to get
and just to be clear, I wasn't speaking mm-hmm. against libraries. I was saying, did voters vote
yes,
on
yes,
set-asides?
Yes, voters
because
voted on that set-aside.
They worry that in downtimes, places like the library are going to be the first to get cut, and so
they do. And
so, in order to protect against that in the future, right?
But we also last year voted to have this city suddenly take over pruning your street trees. So that's another $20 million that suddenly has to come out of somewhere.
Well, right? that came with. Based on a revenue stream that Jane Kim had put in the ballot, a real estate transfer tax, and I had worked on that because in the past that was the city's responsibility to do, and the city pushed it onto the homeowners as a new tax onto them to actually take care of their trees. So
it
actually had
a
funding stream for it.
In any case, I don't feel like the city is in the mood to do the things that John had talked about him having to do 10 years ago, because I think that they see now as a time that is flush. So now is the time to make aggressive spends. And if you look at the battle this year, and I imagine people listening to the show are fairly up to speed on budget things, but I won't use too many jargony words, but we got a $185 million quote-unquote windfall, though we will get it again and again, because we paid too much for property tax. It's complicated, but we got this money. We paid up to the state more than we needed to, and we got money back. And more than half of that money is going to go toward affordable housing. We're making the spends now. Now, you can look and see what we get out of it, but we are spending now because the money is there. As this economy falters, we'll have to make decisions like John made and other leaders made a decade ago.
So, I'd like to be able to add something else here. We have a political system a governance system when it comes to the budget where the politics drives the decision making and not the priorities. And we actually have to figure out how to create a new way of making decisions on how we're going to prioritize to address certain issues and policies. And all too often, it is the politics that drives the decision making. Who do you want to appease? How do you want to look good? What you want to put in place? The Chase Center just opened up. I heard that there was not $1 of money that went to the Chase Center. Actually, there was an item that came before me to spend $30 million on a muni stop for the Warriors Stadium. I voted against it because it's just like anything in the city. It's the wealth and the politics and the power of wealth that drives the decisions, that works like gravity to attract other general fund dollars. The $30 million that went to the muni stop didn't go to the Excelsior, didn't go to the Sunset, didn't go to the Richmond, didn't go to Viz Valley for the important infrastructure that's needed for the MTA. These are the ways that decisions are being made. They're being made just to appease political interests, but not to make sure that we're doing the best for public policy. And that's really the problem in this city of vast wealth.
And to get back to Philip's earlier point, which is, you know, it's the voters who vote these set-asides and these mandates. So when we look at trying to, point fingers here at you know, who created the system that we're in that has in many ways tied our hands in terms of how much discretionary funding there is and how much money can be moved around, what's the chicken and the egg here? Like, is it the voters? Is it the politicians? Is it a little bit of both? You know, every time...
It's the politicians. Our hands are not tied. We have the ability to actually move money from one place to another. We have the ability to actually say that we're going to address the homelessness crisis that we have on our streets with a huge infusion of money, and we choose not to do that. We choose to have less of an amount that goes to address homelessness, or we're not going to create the mental health SF initiative because it's too costly, or because someone else is doing it, I don't get to do it myself as the mayor of San Francisco. Those are the decisions that are being made, but we have the ability, if we want to really put forward how to address the major problems in the city, we have the ability to make decisions on it with the money that we have.
And how does that money get? How does that money get moved around? I'm not sure I understand that because we were just talking about...
Well, the money gets moved around. There's choices that the Board of Supervisors has that during the budget season when it's open before us to cut from one place and put it in another. When I was chair of the Budget Committee, we had the year before I joined the Board of Supervisors, the police overtime spending was $24 million. And I got it down to $10 million. They gave me $12 million to be able to move around in the budget that I could put towards homeless services and mental health services and senior services, prevent privatization. We had choices that we could make about who was going to run the fire department's emergency water system. We actually removed it from the fire department and moved it to the PUC, and that freed up about $6 million to go to other places. There are real choices to make. But departments actually want to hold on to the resources that they have rather than for their own departments and their own spending ability, rather than to actually deliver services elsewhere that will be important to deliver on our major priorities in San Francisco.
So I think that ultimately it's the Board of Supervisors, because the Board of Supervisors passes the budget You know, they're the ones.
It's the mayor and the board.
Well, the mayor and the board of supervisors, but
the mayor has the budget for like 6 months before it gets to the board of supervisors.
Ultimately, it's a political issue. But I also think we're sort of losing sight of the magnitude of the increases. I've heard $12 million. I've heard $20 million for street trees. Mm-hmm. You know, various numbers. The budget grew by $1 billion in fiscal year 17 alone, and another $1 billion this past fiscal year. This is leaps and bounds beyond any sort of, you know, wrinkle in terms of inflation or, you know, normal cost of business increases or population growth, you know, opening the new library in Mission Bay a few years back. We're dealing with very, very substantial sums of money, which even with some of the constraints that the city has, you know, there's still a lot of money to play with. Because
it's true. We did absorb redevelopment, though. Trying to explain it becomes very difficult. And San Francisco is very difficult, and I've been doing it for more than a decade trying to explain the budget. And I, you know, talked to John when he was in government, and I talked to John when he's out of government. But it's almost more helpful to just look at the performance. The amount of money is always going to be a lot, and people are probably complaining about the amount of money, you know, decades ago. But it's better to look at the performance, I think. And with San Francisco, it's very hard to compare San Francisco's performance to other places as a whole because of our unique setup. So it's better to look at individual departments and individual services. And, you know, we were just talking about the libraries. I think we do very well there. Other departments, I don't think we do. And in many cases, that's probably more helpful is to look at what are we getting for it. You know, right now we have the money now. Mm. Are we getting enough? Are we squirreling away?
I just wanted to clarify something, John Avalos, that you said that, yes, we can move the money around, or the Board of Supervisors, that is, and the mayor can move the money around, but it's within the discretionary funding, spending amount.
Absolutely.
You're not talking about moving from other pots that you've talked about earlier. Right?
Right.
Not all of it is in play. It's just how that what's quoted in the Chronicle, the $3.5 billion that's for this current fiscal year's budget is earmarked for discretionary spending. That's where you can move money around.
That's where you can move money around. And some of that money, I believe, is part of the set-asides. And within the set-asides, you can move money around as well. Like, for instance, even within the enterprise departments, you can move money around. Let's say that the airport has a great deal of surplus money. And also has, you could actually create jobs with that. You can create jobs for people who are homeless on the streets, but that's not how the airport wants to spend its money. You can do that with the library. You can create jobs programs for young people in the library and make sure that young people can bring more money into their families to make their families, their households, you know, more economically viable in San Francisco. There's lots of ways you can move money around and create things that can actually have real impact on people's lives in our neighborhoods. The city actually doesn't do enough because the city's driven by the internal politics of how departments and how the departments are run and how departments squirrel away money, how departments are given budget allocation to hire all kinds of staff but choose not to hire them because it's cost saving for the next year, that they can come in and make more choices about, you know, other things they want to spend their money on. You know, our problem with the mental health beds is, you know, a big part of that. There are so many examples that we have in the Department of Public Health that they don't hire nurses that they're supposed to hire, and people who are receiving care in our hospitals have to wait in the hallway to be able to get care because there's enough staff there, although the staff have been budgeted in the budget. So it's, you know, there hasn't been a real effort to make hard choices in years, probably since 2009 and 2010. And that really has to be where the city goes if we want to be able to have a dent in any of these huge disparities in wealth that create the misery that we see on our streets in San Francisco.
So this often comes up as an issue when we talk about budget issues, whether at the state level or the local level, which is that there are hard choices that keep getting passed over. And I definitely want to get to what exactly hard choices mean and how those hard choices get enacted. But first, I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking with Philip Sprinson, author of the recent article on San Francisco's budget, Where Has All the Money Gone? Joe Eskenazi, managing editor of Mission Local, and John Avalos, former supervisor of District 11 and former chair of the Budget and Finance Committee in 2009 and 2010 on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. We invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments. What do you think of San Francisco's budget, where the money is going, and how it could be spent differently? You can join our conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KLW website, tweet us at cityvisionsklw at KLW, or post something on Facebook. There's lots of ways for you to get involved in tonight's conversation. Let's go to our first caller. We have Ariana in San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just feel that there needs to be more of a public participation in our communities and our city, and that there could be some kind of encouragement to not only get better educated, but also that there could be community service so people could take more personal responsibility for the issues at hand. And conversely, I just want to say, and John Avalos was not on the board when this happened, but I'm a psychologist, a community mental health psychologist, and I've been going at times to the board, and it's like getting up against a wall of resistance. And on the particular one of the particular days, they had an article in the Examiner saying that the people were on the internet while we were trying to save our local urban forest, Mount Sutro. They were just ordering food and doing the travel arrangements because Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez had access to their internet records during our hearing process. And lastly, I want to say that, just to make the last point, that there, it's not just about bond issues or money. There's like a lot of unpopular things that we need to be focusing on, like sewers and addressing the climate emergency, and thinking in terms of the long term about how our human needs, who we are as a city, interface with each of us as individuals and in groups, because this city has a long history of take the money and run ethos from the time of the gold rush. And we can say that it's Trump and the Republicans, but it's very much here at home in San Francisco too.
Thanks for your call. All right. So, Joe, you haven't had a chance to talk in a little bit. Say more about what you think of this idea of more civic engagement that Ariana makes a point of. Because I think sometimes when I get the thick book that comes through the mail slot that asks me to figure out how the city should spend its money as a citizen and not as a politician and legislator, that makes my head spin. Is it really more about more civic engagement, or if it is, then in what way? Because we have civic engagement through ballot prop measures and board of supervisor hearings and things like that.
Well, I was born in San Francisco, and I love San Francisco, but I guess that entitles me, and I didn't see the movie The Last Black Man in San Francisco, but the line of you have to love it in order to hate it, I think, is apt, because I will get to your question. I apologize. Too much of what we point out and what Philip points out and what I thought was a lot of apt points in the article are taken by an eager audience of web trolls to point out the misrule of liberals. And I think that's wrong, because San Francisco's misrule is kind of sui generis. Like, we're not doing it right, but I don't think it's because of liberalism. But to get to the point, there's a lot of nastiness in San Francisco politics that I think probably transcends other cities. And this is more or less where I've been in my professional life. But I think for people who would volunteer like Ariana, it can become very difficult because of staggering numbers of meetings and because of incredible animosity that can draw up over seemingly, benign issues. And it can drive people out of public life. As far as the ballot process in San Francisco, that's a whole nother show. We've had 24 or 25 ballot measures on the ballot in the last couple of years. I think that in the early 1990s we had 28. After Z, you get to AA, and that's a result of some of the internecine politics that I think John Mai is alluding to earlier in the show. We make it difficult. We do make it difficult. That said, there are a lot of great ways that people can get involved. But getting involved politically, you're getting into a blood sport. And that's something I don't think is always beneficial.
It definitely is a blood sport. I think what Ariana says is like really key in terms of public participation, and there are actually models that are out there in San Francisco where that is happening. There, maybe a supervisor might look at a small part of the budget to be able to get public input on about how money will be spent. And the supervisor also has the ability, like, which I did in my district, is that we put forward these collaborations among, you know, residents and people who are providing services and have a connection with the neighborhoods to do public planning together about looking at the priorities they want to grow in our districts. When I began as supervisor, we had very little in terms of public services that were in District 11, the Excelsior, the OMI, Lakeview neighborhoods, Cropper Amazon, Outer Mission, very few public services, maybe like a handful. And we're able to grow those into much larger amounts of services that are being provided for after-school programs, for senior programs, to build affordable housing, to create community gardens, to create Saturday events in our parks at McLaren Park, all kinds of things that happened, all because we were able to enhance public participation in the budget. And people actually don't see it as a way of that's drudgery and going to another meeting, actually build relationships and actually move and advance things that you have to change public opinion in order to move forward. We change public opinion by having a community participation survey on affordable housing, and we got two housing projects in District 11, one at the Upper Yard at Balboa Park Station and one at next to Safeway at the funeral home on Mission Street. Both of those projects were driven entirely by residents in San Francisco. So there are models out there. There are structures that can be created to actually enable people to have a say in budgeting and how resources are allocated in the city. It's just not done enough because the politics of the rich and powerful drive a lot of the decisions that are happening at City Hall, especially on the big projects, especially on moving like the big dogs, the infrastructure projects that serve the downtown sector.
I think that civic engagement, like Ariana says, is very important, but it's a two-way street. You know, it's unreasonable to expect that, you know, the average person on the street is going to just pick up the budget and read through it and with all their friends come to a great conclusion what we need. There needs to be some leadership from the city leaders in bringing some of these questions to the people with some clear vision and options of we can do A, B, or C with our wealth. I look to some of our peer cities on the West Coast. The Seattle Puget Sound region passed Sound Transit 3, which was a $40 billion package for development of their light rail system and other transit improvements. Same year, 2016, LA passed Measure M, which was $120 billion, also for huge expansion of LA Metro. So these are two areas which, like us, are now have spending, you know, billions to several billion extra per year, but they're doing it with a vision, because the vision came first. There were advocates who said, we have limitations in our transit in these two regions, and they crafted a package, and they took it to the voters, and they got it passed to get the extra money. And it took a lot of work before Measure M in 2012, Measure J, same package, failed in L.A. They had to go back, rework it, do some more outreach. San Francisco right now is kind of cursed by the Midas touch. We have all the money without having to do the work first to get the vision. We're not having to go to the voters and say, do you want it? You know, our budget is jumping without someone taking and saying, you know, we have this opportunity. Here's some options of what we could do with it, and getting the voters and the citizens to pick one way or the other.
John?
I disagree. There is vision in the city. It's not a problem of lack of vision. It's a city. It's a problem about conflict, about how far to support the vision versus how to appease political interests that will divert attention and resources from what we want to do as a vision. We had a whole process to, you know, look at a 30-year plan for the MTA and how to grow and build our infrastructure for transit in the city. And we went through a whole process with many department heads and residents and people who were involved in advocacy around transportation and transit. And in the end, it was really, City Hall knew what the plan was. They had the vision. They just didn't know how to fund it. And when the funding came, the decisions that they make around funding, was it a sales tax? Was it a bond? It wasn't going to be like a tax on, you know, big businesses that receive a lot of subsidy and support from the infrastructure, they'd all fell apart because we couldn't agree on the sources and how it was going to get done. So I believe that we do have vision and we do have infrastructure that we built on vision. I believe sometimes the infrastructure and the vision is way off. The T line is an example of that. The central subway is an example of that. But we also have the public utilities work that we've done to build out the Hetch Hetchy system. We have an amazing, you know, route to the Golden Gate Bridge that I think is as equally as beautiful as the Golden Gate Bridge. If you, you know, check it out, that was actually a much needed transportation system that was done with our tax dollars that people don't acknowledge that something was done. We have all kinds of examples of that, but it's the conflict about how we, you know, agree on the resources that is the problem in our city. And we need to develop the tools to be able to make better decisions. And public participation is going to be key, part of the ingredients in that tool basket to be able to, you know, make better decisions.
Philip, I feel compelled to interject because John mentioned it twice. You know, after a very dreary intro to my article, I do want to point out that the Hetch Hetchy improvements, the PUC, are one of the things I point out is a successful example of infrastructure work in the city.
And we'll agree on that. I like turning on the faucet and having the water come out, but we did have to go back for a couple extra billion-dollar bond measures. So even that was something that money was not spent as ideally as it could have been.
Correct. But it was, you know, there's an example of where we did have some vision. We had a goal. Some of the engineering to get, you know, protect along the Hayward Fault is, you know, spectacular, you know, unique in the world with, you know, 100-foot-long shifting boxes to protect these pipes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it can be done. It has been done in some small areas. But, you know, the sums we're dealing with are so vast. I feel like there are other key areas, transportation, housing, energy, you know, other issues facing the city that we could do more than just our pipes and say we're achieving incredible things.
Well, transportation is hard. I mean, in San Francisco, again, we are so compact. You know, I focused on transportation very, very heavily, you know, 6, 7, 8 years ago. And this is before anyone had even heard of Uber. So if you're going to spend hundreds of millions or now billions of dollars on transit, a lot of it is to deal with congestion. And the more congested you are, the slower you go. And the slower you go in transit, the more you have to spend to do the same thing. Because let's say an hour-long bus ride, you know, in a pre-Uber day is now going to take an hour and 20 minutes. You're getting less for the same amount of money. So you have to spend more money to do the same thing. And the more congested you are, the more riders you lose, et cetera. It becomes a debt spiral. So like I said, putting your arms around San Francisco's problems can be incredibly depressing and difficult, and it's better to focus on individual things and say, how can we maximize this? And it's just very difficult, and it's hard also to compare us to other people.
So I want to put the number out for listeners to join our conversation here on City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. We're talking about San Francisco's budget. Is it too big? Is it big enough? Is the money being spent correctly? Is the return on investment what we want it to be? We're talking with three guests tonight. Philip Sprisson, who's written an article in the City Journal about this very question. Joe Eskenazi, managing editor of Mission Local. And John Avalos, former supervisor of District 11 and former chair of the Budget Committee and Finance Committee on the board in 2009 and 2010. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. So first, I want to go back to you, Philip, for one quick second. You mentioned Seattle and Los Angeles as two cities that have shown that they can have vision and put money behind it and have big infrastructure projects. What do you know about Seattle and Los Angeles's budgeting process and whether they work within the same constraints that San Francisco does in terms of what's discretionary and what's fixed?
I am not as familiar. I know that for both of these measures, they were ballot measures and bond measures, creating a specific sales tax, or I believe in the Seattle case, it was a basket of taxes, car registration and property taxes and others devoted to a specific purpose. So, you know, it's not entirely comparable to San Francisco, but I would point out that, you know, our wealth in terms of what's coming in sales taxes and property taxes anyways is matching or exceeding probably on a per capita basis what they got by introducing a new tax. Because even though we haven't raised our sales tax, there's so much economic activity in the city, prices are growing so much, property taxes are going up. Like I said, it's almost like the Midas touch. We're getting the effect of a large ballot measure tax without having to pass it. That should be an enormous opportunity because that in some ways makes it easier. You know, you don't have to worry about the risk of a Measure J failing and then your vision doesn't happen. However, we don't have anyone, you know, charting a clear course to say, if we have an extra billion a year, if we have an extra $3 billion over 4 years, what could we do with what's left over, even after we carve out the certain set asides or certain money goes to, landing fees are committed to the airport. Fine. Our landing fees didn't go up $3.7 billion since 2016. There is some extra money out there that we could be making some choices about.
And then, Joe, I wanted to go back to you. You brought something up earlier before the first break around looking at the departments, right? Because mm-hmm. it's really hard to otherwise understand how the city budget works and what the return on investment is. So tell us how you look at that. How do you look at the city departments and understand if they're delivering in the ways that we'd like them to?
I wish there were persnickety audits of the sort there were a decade ago. I miss those. I don't feel like we're getting those like we used to. John's old boss, Chris Daly, used to like to look under the couch for money. Sean Elsburn used to raise hell about that. People used to do those kinds of audits. Now, that doesn't make for great reading, but it is a great way of understanding how things work. I can think of a few departments right now that need audits severely, and one of them has the initials DPH. I would look at how people get their services. I would look at the basic services that we need to get. Certainly money is important, and in San Francisco we spend lots of money, but as I've said a few times, I'm more concerned with what we get for it. San Francisco fancies that it can solve America's problems. That doesn't always work, but I would like to see what we get for it, and I'd like to focus on the departments. John brought up the DPH as well. I'd really like to see a focus on outcomes. 10 years ago, we didn't even look at outcomes. I'd like to focus on that.
I appreciate that Joe's been bringing this up. We haven't made it a focus of conversation tonight, but later on in my article, I do talk about, the limits of what money can do. And, just throwing more money at a problem doesn't solve it. And, an article that Joe did a couple weeks ago about empty beds at San Francisco General Hospital for long-term care. 45 beds, bought, paid for, not a person in them because of management issues. They were choosing to leave the beds empty. We could double that budget, and then we just end up with 90 empty beds, which still means zero people helped. And that's a very big issue that San Francisco's facing, because even if we don't choose to, have a vision and do a major infrastructure project, if we've let all of our individual agencies' budget grow 12% this year, 10% next year, and on, and nothing changes, well then, that's a problem in itself. Because ideally, even if you're not doing something big, at least we're getting 10% better health care, 12% better transportation at the margins, but that isn't always happening.
And I believe John was intimating this when he points out that money is often saved by skimping on hiring, and I understand the notion of not building up pension costs, et cetera, but at some point you're not delivering services.
And John, what of this idea that there needs to be more auditing, more looking for the return, the outcomes for the money that is invested in the various city departments? What does that look
like? Totally agree. Actually, Joe and I talked about this about 2 weeks ago. There hasn't been any real serious audits in 10, maybe even 15 years. Of our departments, how effectively they're running, how they can be more cost effective, are they actually hitting their stated outcomes? That hasn't really been done. It's been budgeting by addition only. And when you're budgeting by addition, you don't want to look in the rearview mirror to see what's not getting done. And it's more about how do you, appease political interests versus the work done that needs to get done that'll make San Francisco dollars go to effective service delivery.
So then, what would it take to get that kind of culture, so to speak, back into city government of really looking at this in a more detailed way?
All it would take would be one person on the Board of Supervisors to call for an audit that could be done by the budget analyst or the controller's office. And the controller's office actually has, you can pass legislation to describe a series of audits that could be done. If one person puts forward, that effort, I would imagine everyone else would jump on because they don't want to look like they're not being wise about how we deliver our services in the city. The controller probably has, done a lot of work on service delivery and efficiency, but those haven't been raised to and elevated to public discourse the way they could as well.
And with all due respect, 10, 15 years ago was before you were or while you were on the board or before you were on the board.
I was a legislative aide to Chris Daley when I was on the board of before I was on the board of supervisors.
Yeah.
So 2005 I was on
okay.
The board.
So then when you were on the board, I'm just curious, not because I'm trying to stick it to you, I'm just trying to ask, what was the politics like? Were you able to? Did you consider calling for audits? And if you didn't, why
Absolutely.
Didn't you?
I was chair of the budget committee.
Yeah.
I moved $42 million the first year and $37 million the next year.
So
and that was based on getting the budget analyst to look at where we can do cost savings. We looked at one audit we did was we were very top heavy in managers in San Francisco. So we looked at the management level staff and how to reduce the ratio of increase the ratio of line staff to managers. We also had an audit that we had done that in 2009, maybe 2010, on the number of information officers that were really about polishing the look of the city departments and how essential were they needed. It was easier to do these things at that time because we were facing a $500 million budget deficit. Mm. But since that time, it's gotten easier, and it's been, you know, much easier to do it outside of that. I wasn't chair of the budget committee in other years, mm-hmm. and the budget chair has a great deal of power to mobilize, you know, the resources or the colleagues on the budget committee to align together. And what we've done and what has been a problem with balance of the budget, be it Mark Farrell or Malia Cohen and working with the mayor's office, is that they were rubber stamping the mayor's budget, and then they were basically getting input from each member of the Board of Supervisors so there would be no opposition to the budget because everyone got what they wanted. But when it came to actually really measuring how effective the budget was going to be on its marks, that wasn't part of the equation.
The Joe, I was just thinking, you've reminded me, John, that the audits of the Rec and Park Department were so scathing that they actually were something that you could just take out and read, you know, as if it was a serialized novel. I remember that they were upset because a specific boathouse couldn't account for its spending because they didn't have a cash register, you know, stuff that specific. And, you know, Philip brought it up in his article. The parks look better than they did 10 or 15 years ago, and we decided to spend on that. We passed, I believe, multiple bonds. And we can complain about what they've done with some of that, and certainly they didn't build everything they said they could, and we can look at the progress of the bonds. But the parks do look better now, and the playground infrastructure does look better now, and that's something that makes people happy. Even as we have fewer and fewer children, the playgrounds look better and better. But, you know, I mean, when the city...
That indicator actually varies across the city. The power of that indicator mm-hmm. varies across the city. With District 11, the parks are like everything because we don't have a lot of other, you know, public infrastructure. So that's a big indicator for us in District 11, how well our parks are maintained.
I'd have to wonder if there's a correlation between the audits 10 or 15 years ago and then the park bonds pretty much immediately followed that. I believe they were 2008 and 2012. And there's mm-hmm. been, as I mentioned in the article, very excellent performance out of those bonds. Again, you could probably argue, did we get everything we want or something perfect? But my children use the redone playgrounds, and they're phenomenal. They look world class. You talk about San Francisco being a leading city. Our playgrounds and parks right now are spectacular.
Absolutely.
And it probably speaks to something that immediately before that, someone was raking the parks department over the coals. And then when they got a big pile of money, they were thinking, well, I got to account for this and do something good with it, otherwise they're going to come back and be asking me more uncomfortable questions.
We have an email from Rob that says, looking around San Francisco, I just don't see where the billion-dollar increases in the budget are going. It all needs to be audited. I just want to, in the last five or so minutes of the program, go back to something you said, John Avalos, earlier on, which is that in order to do this, we have to make some hard choices. And I promised I would ask you what those hard choices were going to look like and what would it take, because that's kind of always one of the pillars of a conversation like this. So say more about those hard choices.
Well, I think the hard choices is that we have to align behind particular services. When we are fighting for, let's say, look at the Board of Supervisors. You have 11 districts, and every supervisor wants to get a bunch of projects that they promised their residents in the district. They actually have to say they can't have them all, and they have to align behind what are the citywide things that we want to be able to get. If we want to put more funding into homeless shelters, navigation centers, We have to make choices to actually cut things from our list that we promised from our residents. And we have to go back to our residents and be able to tell them that we have to make these hard choices because, you know, our city is struggling with many people who are on our streets without a place to live and living in tents and living very much in misery. And we have to limit all the things we want to get out of our budget. We have to shorten our list of pet projects in our districts or in the mayor's office. They have to, you know, not try and do everything and focus on particular things altogether. And then there are other departments like we have to make decisions on. Like, you know, you could do an audit of the Department of Public Health, and I guarantee you it's not going to necessarily result in cost savings. I mean, one audit is like, how come they're not able to hire all the staff to do the mental health services and the emergency care services that they want to do? Well, the end result of that audit would be to hire more staff, which is going to cost more money and, you know, cost more in our pensions. There could be other cost savings as well. But the hard choices, we know what we want to be able to do. We know what problems are the biggest ones we want to address. We know that we want to be able to create, you know, more affordable housing in San Francisco. What are we not going to cut? What are we going to cut to make sure that we can do that? What is the difference in police allocation and deployment what we have to change in order to be able to, you know, put money elsewhere? If we're actually just using our police department, which I don't think it does a really good job of preventing crime. If we're just using it to react to crime, what can we do, you know, differently that can actually create cost savings in the police department? That question's never made because the police have a great deal of power to get the budget they want to get. Right now, when I talked about, you know, 2009, when the police department overtime budget was like $25 million, I got it down to $10 million, maybe $9 million in 2010. Now it's back up to $24 million. And people don't want to cut that overtime budget. But that overtime budget can go to other things for homelessness and mental health that currently are underfunded.
Joe, I want to get to you. We have a couple of minutes left. Do you think that alignment of values and the population's priorities is really there, that we could redirect in a way and say, you know what, we're going to forgo these other things because these are the priorities that we as a city agree on? Is it that simple?
I think that would be a good thing to do. But, you know, I mean, as all of us have intimated, there are political considerations that make altruistic budgeting very difficult. It's difficult because in San Francisco, budgets don't work like Uncle Scrooge's money bin. You can't just say, you know, money saved here can go to there. On the other hand, that also can lead to compartmentalized thinking, where John's right that you would increase the health department budget to hire more people to provide more services, but that would also lower the amount of money that you spend ministering to people on the street and, you know, overall probably would lead to money being saved, let alone better outcomes for people's lives. But we don't think along those lines. So we have very kind of, you know, parochial thinking in terms of each budget, budgeting for each department, but then at the same time, we will look at the budget overall and say it's out of control.
Right. And Philip, last word goes to you. If hearing this conversation tonight, thinking about what you've written, where would you like to see happen to kind of get us unstuck and moving in the right direction here?
I think two big things that have come out. One is an audit. We are spending very, very vast sums of money, and everyone agrees that, you know, we don't have very clear transparency on where it's going and what we're doing with it.
Audits are cheap. Audits are cheap.
And audits are very cheap. Yeah. Audits usually pay for themselves and what you save or what you find. Mm-hmm. And I think the other is making some hard choices within the city about some of these fixed allocations. You know, a lot of this was done 10 or more years ago when there was a time of recession and budgets were tight and people wanted to protect certain things, make sure the politicians didn't cut items like libraries that the populace found very valuable. We're in the exact opposite situation now. I think perhaps it's time to reevaluate how we allocate some of those on a percentage or other basis to give us some flexibility. Because to say that, you know, you can't just move money around like Uncle Scrooge in San Francisco, that in itself is a political choice that the city's population's leaders have made. We could choose to do it differently and give the Board of Supervisors much more flexibility in where they take money from and where they give it to in order to achieve different outcomes.
And John, wouldn't it take another set of budget initiatives to be able to unlock some of this money?
If you talk about set-asides, if you want to unlock that, I believe that there's a flexibility you can make just through the typical budget process if it's transparent and there's people watching what the mayor does through the board process. The mayor puts out budget instructions at the end of the year, maybe November, early December, and basically the mayor says to all the departments, cut your budgets by 1.5% or 3%, give us your prediction of what your budget's going to come in at, but there's no other instructions that go with that. I think there could be like some instructions that actually are about, like, these are what we want your department to grow at, and if we want to be able to tackle homeless services, what is your plan to do that in a new way? Those ideas aren't out there. They're not being asked of, you know, departments, and those asks should be made in that at that time, and then those asks are made throughout the 6-7 months it takes to finalize the budget, and it's just, you know, not done that way. And that's the way I did it when I was on chair of the budget committee. I worked every day. We had hundreds of people coming to meetings in March for that to happen, and that's the way to get it done publicly.
All right, we got to stop our conversation here. That's City Visions for this evening. I want to thank my guests, Philip Sprinson, Joe Eskenazi, and former supervisor John Avalos. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. I'll be back next Monday. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.